Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Jane Cron Show. Today, I've handed over my captain seat to two really wonderful guys who are going to interview my fabulous guest today, Lynn Lifshin. My first host is Stephen Morse. Say hello, Stephen.
Hello. Thanks for letting me talk on your show again. I'll try not to fill up as much airtime as I did last time, I think. I'm more interested in what Lynn has to say.
It should be an interesting show.
So this, Lynn, would you I have some general questions in mind that I'm always interested in, or do you have something you'd rather start off with?
Let me introduce Joseph Trombatore real quick, you guys, and then, Stephen, I'll let you go ahead and kick it off. But the co-host today will also be Joseph Trombatore, and I'm going to put Joseph on the line right now.
Hello.
Hello.
Stephen. Hello, Lynn.
Yeah. Hi, Joseph.
Okay, we're picking each other up here. I love this internet radio. It's always an adventure. Janie does a particularly good job of getting people on that make it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the media itself is kind of fun. So, Joe, do you have any questions that you've always wanted to ask of Lynn?
Well, yes, quite a few, but what I'm thinking of right now is Lynn, your passion for dancing and ballet classes. I think that has a lot.
I didn't even know about that. I'm telling you how much I know about what you've been doing lately.
Comes into your poetry so much. I think it's just amazing.
Well, I have, ballet was a theme. In fact, someone's doing a book called Ballet Madonnas. And recently I've been sort of obsessive about ballroom, and I've been doing a lot of poems about that. But it seems like I take any subject and, begin writing about it, and then I don't stop. So it's something new will happen tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you wanted me to read some of the older poems and start off with something that is really very strange. Every once in a while, I get a letter. I know this has been anthologized, and I get something from a student asking me what this means. I just usually write back, tell them just to read it. But would you want me to start with reading a poem or two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, this is probably one of the more anthologized ones, and it's My Mother and the Bed. No, not that way, she'd say when I was 7. Pulling the bottom sheet smooth, you have got to. Almost singing, hospital corners. I wet the bed much later than I should have. Until just writing this, I hadn't thought of the connection. My mother would never sleep on sheets someone else had. I never saw any stains on hers, though her bedroom was a maze of powder, hairpins, black dresses. She used to bring her own sheets to my house, carried toilet seat covers. Lynn, did anybody sleep in my? She always asked. Her sheets, her hair smelled of smoke. But when she came to my house, she said, Lynn, these rooms smell funny. I remember once we drove at 3 a.m., slowly into Boston, and stripped what looked to me like 2 clean beds as the sky got light. I smoothed on the form-fitted flower bottom. She redid it. She thought of my life as a bed only she could make right. For some reason, that poem has been picked from a lot of different anthologies, and I guess I picked it myself when I included it in one of the first anthologies I edited. So it's sort of funny, but it's also kind of sad and true. And
yeah, I guess the nostalgic humor is the kind of thing that you might hear at a loving kind of a memorial service for someone.
Well, my mother and I were very close, and yet probably some of my most harsh poems, connect to her. And people would say, "My God, you wrote that about your mother? How can you read it?" And the only thing that bothered my mother would be if somehow I wouldn't let her see it, or if the mail came and she was visiting and I quickly tried to, shove it under the door and not let her see it. Then she'd get suspicious and get upset. But otherwise, unlike some people who have certain poems in mind that if I read them, I remember my ex-husband once said, I ever see that poem again, I'm going to leave. And he eventually did.
Puns. Writers don't use puns.
Well, fortunately, that's too long a poem to read on the air. So
it's way too much punishing us anyway. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the first nice day we've had here in Minnesota for a while.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that poem. There's obviously an affectionate undertone to the whole thing, but the humor I was hoping it wasn't inappropriate to chuckle at spots because it made me chuckle.
Oh, I really want that. And I usually, you know, when I do a reading, you can only listen to a certain number of really serious poems. I always try to pick some that are, you know, not only moving, but also, you know, funny.
Well, I tell you, that's a real change of pace for most of what's going on the web right now. Did you read much on the web, Lynn?
I think I have. I am such a bad record keeper, but I shouldn't admit that. Yeah, I do publish on the web. It seems like every magazine now has become, you know, something that's published mostly on the web.
Well, I was just curious. Well, a lot of the poetry that I read, at least I still kind of dabble with editing, as you know, that's how we first met.
Exactly.
Years ago. Is actually through MySpace and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, it's awful. And I don't mean that it's badly written. I mean that it's awful. Committing suicide, throwing up in their toilets. It's very well written, but if you get my... But it's awful.
Someone just wrote to me on I think it was on Facebook, and they had an interesting perception. They said that, you know, like from the 70s on until fairly recently, you know, there were mainly magazines, which might not have had an enormous circulation. Mm-hmm. But now with the Internet, I mean, there's just so many poets that there's like millions and millions, and there's not really any who have published a lot more. You know, it's a totally different scene, really.
It is, and that's of course, one of the things that I would want to talk to you about is, We've both seen it from when it started, really actively, almost just like, I remember being excited about copy machines or ditto machines.
Oh, yeah, exactly, mimeograph machines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, but there was a fascinating article that was the front cover of the New York Times Book Review, and it was the Mimeo Revolution, and
yeah.
It was just this gorgeous photograph of all kinds of magazines from... Alcorno and Pomato and, you know, little tiny stapled together magazines. And there was a real excitement and energy there. And now everything is very slick. And I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I don't think these magazines would get on the cover of New York Times.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, did we share that observation. I'd like to hear you read some more poetry, too. I mean, I'm also kind of greedy. One of the things, you know, before I let you go, and then I'll get out of the way, Joe, I've been kind of hogging the time. One of the things that I noticed while working with you a couple times, one time in particular, I have this young granddaughter, Willow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were working for a friend. You were
exactly
trying to put together a poem for a friend.
The Alma poems.
Yes.
Right.
And I took them all and ran them together, at least all that you sent me, just to show people how some poets work. And that was real epiphany for me. The different takes that I might have just said that all these were just drafts and kind of set them aside and never looked at them again, you actually considered them as separate takes.
Well, a friend of mine, it's so odd that you mentioned this because just 2 days ago someone mentioned those poems to me, and it sort of reminded me that I had written them because a friend of mine, after going through a whole lot of problems, I mean, she just had so much trouble trying to adopt a baby, finally got was getting a new baby, and she was so excited about it, and she asked several of her writer friends to write poems for the baby. And one of the other things that I tend to do is, I mean, I get started on a subject, and then I just kind of run with it. And that's how the Alma poems came about. You know, I read about Guatemala, and I talked to someone from Guatemala, and, you know, I just loved all that lush imagery from that area. But that's sort of what happened so much with probably my most successful book that, in terms of selling, is a book about a racehorse called The Licorice Daughter, My Year with Ruffian. And now, you might have heard about Ruffian lately because she's being compared to beautiful filly Rachel, but I didn't really know that much about her, and somehow a student of mine once years ago said to me, "You don't know anything about Ruffian? Can't you understand that I'm like her? I have MS, and she has had an injury, and neither one of us would give up." So I wrote a little poem then, and then for some reason, some years later, like not too far away, mm-hmm. I started writing about her. And that book, I just obsessed about it, and it became a book that has sold more, you know, than anything else I've done. And now I'm waiting desperately for a book about the other racehorse, Barbara, who you probably know about, who was injured in the Preakness and then, you know, spent a long time trying to recover. And that book is due. In fact, it's due very soon, and I've had a lot of frustrations waiting for it, but I think that's a similar type of book, and I hope it comes. Every day I look for the UPS man, I think it's coming.
Well,
but that's kind of the way I work off, and I, you know, whether it's Barbie or Marilyn Monroe, or someone said to me they wanted me to write poems about poets who were, you know, just personal poems about poets. Well, what they really wanted was like a, you know, a yellow journalist gossipy thing, and the last thing I'm going to do is start writing poems about people. But if they're dead, you know, you can have Shakespeare coming over here for coffee, and, you know, you can have Chaucer, you know, taking a walk on Halloween, and that wasn't what they wanted. But I have a new book. Well, doesn't have a publisher yet. It's had a lot of publishers and it's fallen through, but I sort of go with subjects sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you decide to write a book about poets, my hand is up in the air.
The title is what I think. Well, it's called, let's see, All the Poets Have Touched Me, Living and Dead, All True, Especially the Lies. So it's, I hope it's an intriguing title, but it's gone through about three publishers who were going to do it, and then one thing or another has delayed it, so it's not out.
We were looking for a different take on it, yeah.
Yeah.
What was the working title again that you just gave me?
I'm sorry.
What was that working title
you
just gave?
All the poets, mostly, who have touched me, living and dead, all true, especially the lies. I think I've got that little botch or something like that.
I like that, especially the live.
Yeah.
Joe, let
yes.
me get out of the way and let you ask some questions that I know you want to ask, and I want to hear them myself,
okay.
If you don't mind.
Well, no, something I wanted to talk to you about, Lynn, was your ability to take a subject, work up a poem, and then like a director or a cinematographer, you take it and look at it from the top and from the side and from underneath, and you dive inside the piece, and it'll be like 9, 10, 11 pieces on the same subject.
Or 100.
Yeah, that too. And it's just, I just love that about your writings.
Well, I don't know why that actually happened, but it you're right. It does seem to be... sometimes it's actually a lot of these things have come out of the request. You know, someone was doing a Marilyn Monroe book. Well, I didn't know anything about her, but I just moved to this area. And so I tried to imagine being Marilyn Monroe and what it would be like, you know, going to the museums, being lonely in a, you know, an apartment right near the White House, and just, you know, all kinds of things. Or I went to see the Peruvian mummy who was on display at National Geographic, and she was actually very beautiful. I don't know if any of you remember, but Bill Clinton at the time said, gee, I wouldn't mind having lunch with her. she was a mummy. She was still very pretty. And then I got on a kick with that, and then I imagined, well, what if she were to get friendly with the Unabomber? So I just, these weird things take off, and then I don't let them go right away. But it seems like a lot of them have come about requests for an anthology. I didn't know anything about Barbie. I had to do Barbie research, and then I ended up with a group of Barbie poems, the same thing with Marilyn. And then someone was doing, Denise DeHamel was doing an anthology of Jesus poems. The last thing I ever thought I would ever write about, but I ended up doing that, and Future Tense did a small book, and now someone else has just within, you know, a month or so has done a book, and I've just begun reading poems from that. So it just seems like these people ask me to do something, and then I sort of take off from there.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Oh, it's just amazing.
Yeah, and I was afraid to read any of the Jesus poems because this is a very fleshly, you know, down-to-earth, very down-to-earth Jesus. But I read one about a week or two ago at the Cafe Lena in Saratoga, and everyone liked it, so I'll probably read it again.
Great. Well, are you going to read some for us today?
Okay, I'll read. Want to hear that one?
That would be wonderful.
Read what?
It's Jesus and Madonna.
Okay.
It's kind of wild, but it's reverential. Please, I don't mean it not to be. He was writing poems about her when I first met him. It wasn't only her fame. To him, she was a lost sheep, a lost sweet. And he always said, there but for the grace of. He was thinking how his mother was a Madonna, too. And who was he to judge her? Actually, I think he found her sexy. And he always wanted to multiply and be fruitful. And even in those days, Madonna was talking about wanting to have a child, wanting the perfect father. To come out of one Madonna and enter another world would be a miracle, I suppose. I guess I was a little jealous. I tried to convince myself he was attracted to her because he wanted to save her, and there was a lot to save her from. I know someone said, maybe in People magazine, that when J.C. cured a blind man, let him, after years of darkness, see the light again. He didn't want anyone to know he did these miracles, but somehow it got out. I think he planned this. In fact, it was probably Madonna's fame that got him going after years of being all over the world in his mother's arms, on stamps as the baby Jesus. Now, handsome and strong, all the women said it, and smelling so nice too. A stamp, for he's in the arms of another Madonna, might bring out the National Enquirer, rekindle the fervor of those early days. Even Nightline and CNN would spread his word in English, in 52 languages, and Leno and Letterman would fall prostrate before him, kissing his feet on the air. So it's, you know, sort of a lighter poem.
I'm sorry. I understand that it was very reverential, but it was also very witty.
Well, I hope, you know, I hoped it was.
It was. I'm sorry. If something strikes me as witty, I react to it.
Well,
which that was. That was good. go ahead, Joe. Your questions are getting some good results here. I'm sitting back and enjoying the poetry.
Well, I have so many. I wanted to talk more about that particular collection because it's a very unusual topic for a poetry collection, and I'm just curious to see how you handle it because I'm one of your biggest fans.
Well, thank you so much. That's the only poem I've ever read from it. And, the first small edition came out, and I was really nervous because this was from Future Tense. There was a minister in the audience, and, you know, I thought, oh, my God. I didn't read from it, but it was on the table. And he took a look at it, and he bought 30 copies because he said, you know, that's what we need. We need a real in-the-earth Jesus, you know, not
mm-hmm.
one that people can identify with. So I took a deeper breath and felt better. But I always worry sometimes that, some poems will get me into trouble. I mean, I used to feel that way about family poems. I never knew who would be offended by something or upset or poems about relationships. I mean, there's always a little bit of a risk with that, I always feel. And I tend to just kind of plow ahead, but I have had sometimes when, you know, people are not thrilled to be in a poem, but not too often.
Mm-hmm.
So what kinds of poems have you found that people are uncomfortable with, let's put it that way?
Well, the one poem that I'm not going to read because it's too long, but It's actually on my website, and you can hear me reading it.
Okay.
It's a poem about the man who goes into the woods. But In my new book, Persephone, I had a couple of poems, and I wasn't sure how the poet who possibly, you know, influenced it would react to it. And I kind of felt I had to warn him before I published the book, which is, that came out around January. And in the end, he told me how much he loved the poem. So you never really know. I could read one of those poems. It's, you know, it's not really, I don't think it's really that harsh, but would you like me to do that?
Yeah.
Your choice. I'd love to. Yeah.
Okay, it's called The Margaritas. And it's also very different from the two poems I read, in a different style. The margaritas were blue with paper roses. Later, I thought how they were the only salt of those nights. His email letters like skin, very taut. What he didn't say drugged me. Language was wild and tense. I could feel him, his screen name a tongue. Verbs taut. What he didn't say a drug. It was a dangerous tango. I wanted his body glued to mine. Distance kept the electricity vivid. It was a dangerous tango. How could I know his mother leaped into Niagara Falls? I fell for his words, what he left out. How could I know he was ice? How could I know his mother leaped into the falls? Even in the heat, he was icy. His name was Snow. Last night, we drove through fog until 3. He told me things he said he'd never told anyone. My thigh burned where it touched him. On our last night, we drove through Austin mist talking. I was burning. He photographed me, exhausted at 3 a.m. Everything he told me was a scar. My hair curled in a way I hated. After that night, I wasn't sure I would be pretty again. Everything he told me was a scar. Under the ice, the anger in him was lava. I wanted him, always longing for men with something missing. The margaritas were the only salt I'd taste. The anger in him was lava under the ice. I wanted more, my longing a scar. When he didn't write, I printed his old email. When I no longer looked for it, his email was there, like a mugger. The margaritas were strong with black paper roses. That's kind of a different type of poem for me. And, yeah, kind of, you know, kind of subtly knife-like, I think.
What?
Subtly like a knife, in a way. A little sharp. But someone who, you know, I'm always interested when someone has a favorite poem, and somebody told me that they really liked this poem, and it wasn't one I'd even considered reading, but then I started reading it maybe 2 or 3 readings ago and found that I liked reading it, and it seemed the audience liked it.
It has a good rhythm, too.
Yeah, and it also uses repetition. It's not a formal poem, but it has a, you know, kind of a, you know, like the first line and the second, you know, there is sort of a form to it, but it's not a sonnet or anything. That's one of the hardest things, though, I think, is picking out poems for a reading. You know,
I know.
Yeah. For me, the tendency is to pick something that's worked before, and I'm really more nervous about picking out, you know, something I've never read. And so when someone tells me something to read, then I feel better about it.
You like to be guided that way. I understand that. Yeah. Then of course, if it's a bad choice, the audience has no taste.
Right. I had one nightmare reading years ago, and I won't say who it was, but a very well-known poet introduced me, and it was part of a series. Not only did she not come to dinner as she was invited, but she introduced me and then very loudly walked out the door, which was really kind of rude. And I had decided that night to only read new poems. It was my worst reading I ever did. I swore I'd go home and never give another reading. But it was long enough ago, so I can laugh about it.
Well, that sounds like a horrible experience.
It was.
Yeah.
Is this someone we would know?
Yes, you would.
Mm-mm.
Mm-hmm. And it's someone whose poetry I happen to really like, too. But
well, that's a shame.
Yeah, I've now, see, that's the kind of thing that this person who wanted me to do, you know, poems about poets would have loved, you know. But
right.
You know, there's no way I'll write something about somebody living, and you know,
looking
no way.
Kind of the Lynn Lifton version of Dorothy Parker or something.
Right, and then I'd probably, you know, never be published again, or I'd have more enemies than anyone could imagine. Another really awkward reading was, actually, I've often thought it would be fun to do an anthology of different poets' you know, worst readings or the most uncomfortable. I was at an art colony, and it was just before they really opened, so there were only about five people there, and among them was John Cheever. And I was really young. I was the youngest person there, and Diane Rakowski and I were there, and we were going to give a reading together. And she would read one poem, and then I would alternate and read the second one. And you know how long hers are. They're beautiful, long stories. You know, they just, they wrap you up, and then they hold you. Well, she would read a poem, and he would say, "Wow, that's wonderful." And I would read a little short poem, and he would say something like, "Oh, what kind of a crazy person wrote that?" This went on and on. That was the night that I really went up to my room, and I said, "I will never, never, I will never write another poem again." But I did write the poem called Fat, which was just so I'd have a long poem to read at a reading if I ever read with her again. But it was really a painful night. Those two probably were the worst.
Poets could be so cruel to each other.
And I'm sure everyone has those experiences, you know?
Well, when you're young, you don't expect to be treated that way by people who
right.
have been in the field for a while.
Right. I think Diane and I were the only poets, and there was John Cheever, and there was a painter and possibly a composer. And we were all in this little room, and it was like I couldn't escape, you know. And there wasn't like an audience. It was just a few of us sitting around. And years later when I met him, I pretended I didn't know him. And he said to me, "Yes, I met you." And I said, "No, I don't think so." He said, "Don't you remember I was trying to get your attention by making all these nasty comments?" So that was like years later, but all those years I felt terrible. Oh, well, I guess there's worse things than that.
Too bad for him. Yeah. Interesting stuff. one of the questions that I plan to ask you've already answered is you know, do you write for subjects and themes? And obviously that's your preference, it sounds like.
I really like it when someone asks me to write something so I don't get caught up in writing the same old, you know, blues type of poem, or you know, I notice a lot of my poems are written on the metro, and I keep seeing the metro mentioned in these poems, and sometimes I feel like I need a brand new mm-hmm. subject. Or, you know, I wrote so many mother and daughter poems for years and years, and when my mother was ill, I wrote an awful lot of poems about her that I'm very happy with. But, you know, and then I write relationship poems, and except for Ballroom, I haven't really. And the Barbara book. I haven't come across something new and obsessive, but I'm sure I will.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that Sylvia Plath's influence or the confessional poets generally have kind of made those sorts of choices more difficult or easier?
I think maybe easier, actually. I know, you know, Sylvia Plath and Sexton were two of the first poets that I read, because I had been in the graduate program and I was only reading, you know, 16th and 17th century poets. I mean, I didn't even read anything past Donne. You know, I was so immersed in that. And when I found out, you know, that there were these other poets, and then Bukowski, and, you know, just the poets who wrote about things that were wild, you know. And after I left graduate school, not too happy, in fact, for a while, several of the poems that were most anthologized were about my experience in graduate school, where I thought I was going to be, you know, get my PhD at 21, and then I ran into trouble. But I wanted to be, you know, more like them. You know, I didn't want to. Now I think I've evened out a bit.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest questions that people ever, particularly young writers, ever ask me, and I bet you get it too, is how do I go about getting published and famous like you?
now anyone can really by just putting it on the internet, but
do you get asked that kind of question?
Oh yeah, I do, and what I usually say is that, you know, before I even submitted anything, I mean, I I got the first copy of the, you know, Death's Directory, Len Fulton's Directory, which at that point was a little staple book. And I wrote and got sample copies of about 100 magazines. And so I had a sense of, you know, even though I hadn't read that much contemporary, really contemporary poetry, that gave me a little bit more sense of what was being written and what could be written. And I tell you, I was, you know, at that point, every day that a new packet of magazines came, I was so excited. At the time, I was working for a television station, and, you know, I would take these books with me and hope that there would be a free moment. I was thrilled. I mean, every day there was a new favorite magazine, and, you know, Wormwood one time, and just, you know, magazines that that I didn't even feel good enough to submit to, so I didn't even start submitting to them. But I finally did, and, you know, my first submission was two versions of the same haiku. To this day, I can remember the mailbox I mailed it from. But and luckily, I think they were rejected, but luckily the second poem I wrote was accepted by a magazine called Folio that came from the South. And it was a beautiful magazine, and, you know, it's funny. I remember that it was like in August, and I was just, you know, I can remember sitting outside under the tree and just feeling, well, this is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah.
Now it's harder to remember where things were and where they, you know, were.
That's really interesting. You told in an interview I've read of you before that Laura Stamp did.
Right.
You were talking about your early experience with him. I'm just blanking on his name, Bukowski's publisher. What's his name?
Oh, John Martin.
Yeah.
Oh, God. There's, you know, I will never, never, never find anyone quite like that.
Yeah.
I just adore that man.
He was, well, obviously, he had a gift for finding writers that were worth reading and that people would want to read. And
to this day, I remember it was on May 5th, 2002, when I got the letter that he was not going to continue Black Sparrow. And just before that, he had said to me that he was happy the way the books were doing, and he wanted to do a book every other year. And I had another book ready to go. And when I got that news, I mean, it was really devastating. I had told him I wouldn't publish, you know, he wanted me not to publish anything else. And for around the time I was doing that, I didn't submit anything, and I didn't publish anything else.
I remember that's what you told Laura, and I thought, wow, that is it's almost a sad story.
It was sad because I only had two books published, and the third one, which did come out from Black Spirit Godine, you know, and it's a beautiful book, and came out a lot later than, you know, it would have come out. But and I hope they'll do more. But you know, John, he did these beautiful books where each writer had a page of art. We did, you know, sold maybe 25 copies of it, and you did a page of art. And it was just, I don't know, everything about that experience was really wonderful.
He understood what I'm still learning, and probably now that at my age, I probably never will learn. But it's the importance of how the poem looks on a page.
Exactly.
The page looks is just as important as what the words actually say sometimes.
Yeah. Right.
Which I think he picked up from W.C. Williams, but it doesn't matter where he got it. He used it.
I have to say I've been really lucky with other editors, too. I mean, Marvin Malone. I mean, Bill Packard was just so supportive. I mean, I'm just grateful to every publisher and editor, you know. And sometimes I've been, you know, a little bit, let's say I haven't followed the rules too carefully and have flooded, you know, I have to say that's my, I have flooded some writers, some magazines. And, you know, I know it can be annoying. But I have to say almost all the editors have been so kind and, you know, publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But Martin is just somehow, you know.
I never break any rules, as anybody can tell you.
Lynn, I'd like to hear you read something from one of your new collections, like Nutley Pond.
Ah, you know, something I don't actually have. I pulled out some things from that, from different books, but I don't have Nutley Pond near me. But maybe I could just tell you a little bit about this, a story about it.
Sure.
Would that be good?
Yes.
I'm here.
this Nutley Pond, I don't know if you have the book, it's got a beautiful cover, and it's, you know, it shows the geese, and they're all nature poems. It's sort of like the opposite of the Jesus poems in a way. I sort of had been writing about them anyway, but one day I looked outside and I saw a goose. Well, first of all, when I first time I moved here and I saw geese, I thought, this is just unbelievable. These huge animals, and they're just, they're so close to the house, it feels like they're like in the same house. And I saw one with a band, and I for some reason I wrote it down. You know, I'm not very good at keeping records, but I wrote it down. And then, do you remember the movie Fly Away Home? It was about a man teaching motherless geese to fly following a ultralight plane.
Yes.
Yeah, and 2020 did something
on
it. Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I went to see that movie, and after the movie I thought to myself, you know, those bands look a little bit similar, but I also wanted to find out more about, you know, about the geese and what to feed them and what not to do. So I saw the number. There was an article in the paper saying the real science behind the film, and it turns out it was pretty accurate. So I either wrote, I must have written a letter. I came home, and there were like about 30 phone calls. Call us at any time. Give us a call. We're desperate to talk to you. It turned out I had seen on Nutley Pond only goose from this experiment that actually had flown and flown back. And I had the numbers, and they don't even know me as a poet. To them, I was the goose girl. So they invited me down when they had a special event to celebrate something to do with, I think they were moving on to swans, and the man who had done the ultralight plane was there. But I don't, let me see. I think I could reach, I have a copy here. I think I could reach and find one little one. Let's see. It's, I haven't actually read from this ever, but let me see. I'll find a really short one.
First.
Let's see. If you can talk while I'm doing that. Okay, let's see. Well, here's, I'll just read the first one in the book. And I just sort of watched the pond. It's really, as I say, there's everything there. Right now there's a lot of, you know, baby ducks and baby geese. And this is just feels. What does that mean? Hello?
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 Hello. I wasn't sure what that meant.
Oh, was there a strange noise?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is fields smolder with light. Temperatures falling. Moon slivers on the rolling skin of water. Geese in half light. Armada of feathers. Wind blows them closer. One silver band glows. They're onyx, black flame in a night fire. It's the pond is just really a part of it. When I first lived here, I used to think the geese recognized me, and you know, I would hear them. I walk back from ballet often at night along the pond, and I used to be sure that they heard me, you know, coming, and they could recognize my voice. And I fed them all the time. And I have to say, a lot of the people are not so happy with, you know, geese being overtaking over the rest of the road. So I've let them, you know, survive on their own more. But the cover of the book is really, it's just what I see every day. If you have the book in front of you, it's just
I don't.
You know, but have you seen it at all? Or? I did send out a lot of.
Yes, I saw the cover.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, you know, it's very peaceful, and I'm happy with the book. It's really. The funny thing is that there was some beaver damage, and the people around here decided to do something about it. And then they decided, well, Nutley Pond is a good name. It was never called that, but I named it that. So they all bought books, so that was really good.
So did the name stick locally?
Definitely. Now it's definitely good. Nutley Pond, and they're talking about, you know, whenever they have a meeting when the Nutley Pond committee meets, and it does work out that way.
Wow, that's almost kind of that's a really neat honor.
I thought it seemed like the kind of book that should go into the, you know, the local bookstores or the local gift shops, even, because it's, you know, it's sort of it's a totally nature, you know, not totally nature. There are some other poems in there too, but it's a very different kind of book. It was published by Goose River Press, and I don't know if you know them, but they tend to do nature and you know, they seem to do books on that idea.
No, are they on, do they have a web connection, or should I look them up?
Yeah, they do. They're also on Amazon. Let me look at the book. I think it's just www.gooseriverpress.com.
Okay.
I can actually, I have my web page in front of me, so I could actually go right to it and let you know. It is, let me see. I'm going through this. I added several poems to it. My website has a lot of poems, so for anyone who wants to, you know, get a sense of it, it is www.linlifshin.com. Okay, and their web is www.gooseriverpress.com.
Okay.
And the other book, Persephone, which I did read, the poems, the Margarita poem, that's from Red Hen. I don't know if I, you know, mentioned that.
Definitely books that I'm going to check out.
Well, I hope so. One of the things is most of these books all came out from between last May and this May. And while that's good, I haven't really been able to promote them quite as much as I'd like to, so I really need to get to work on that.
Well, it's really helpful to me because I've sort of been out of commission for almost the last year. Dealing with cancer, so I'm.
Oh, I'm so sorry. How are you doing?
Well, I'm on the phone and I'm doing pretty the best I've done in a while.
Uh-huh.
I mentioned to Janie earlier in a note that mentally and physically, I'm up for this today. So, yeah, it's going well. But I don't bring that up to talk about that. I am behind in my reading. So it's good to have some leads on some good reads, which you definitely are, always.
Yes. Always, yes, it's wonderful.
Well, so many of my poems did deal with, you know, my mother's illness while she was sick, and one of the pieces of prose that I did, you know, that actually became a small chapbook, which went out of print very quickly, but it was about, you know, about that, and so I'm certainly familiar with it, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's something that's so prevalent, obviously, and, you know, have you written much about it?
I have written, I don't want to turn this into an interview on myself, but I have written one book that I'm very, very pleased with called The Dark Spots Are Cancer.
Oh, that's
and
a great
title. It's actually the crow in it. I have... Kind of like you have with geese,
mm-hmm.
I felt crows were involved in this whole cancer process.
Mm.
And it was not a pleasant image. But I'm really happy with the poems that came out of that.
Oh, I'd like to see them. I've noticed that I did one book that, well, just about the death of a cat, but for some reason I am constantly getting, you know, comments. I mean, I'm getting requests for it. It was done, and it's going to be redone in a little more, little better shape because it had a lot of typos in it and a lot of little problems. It hasn't come out yet, but a lot of people said, I don't care what it looks like. I don't care about the typos. I just need to read it now. And I think books that people, about problems that people are dealing with are so,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just, they're lifesavers to people. I mean, they're just so comforting and so, so important.
Different ways of seeing things. I don't really think that unless, as you have, obviously, I think it's difficult for people to relate to what that illness means, or any illness for that matter, but for cancer in particular is a tough one in our society. Because the main reaction, if you ever really want to kill a conversation, people ask you how you are. Tell them you have cancer, I guarantee you. They'll get away from you as fast as they can.
Is that really true? I guess I'm not really aware of that, but I can. Well, you've said it, so you know, so.
Yeah, so.
That's,
anyway,
that's pretty sad.
But pleasant. So, well, actually, you know, it's part of my life, so whatever. I have to leave a little earlier than I was scheduled to leave. I unfortunately have to go pick up my granddaughter. But it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you.
I hope you don't feel like I'm running out on you or anything.
Oh, no, no, no.
I've certainly enjoyed it. I don't want to be one of those people you tell stories about. Yeah, I was talking to him on the radio, and then just disappeared.
No, it's been a delight to talk with you.
It's been a delight to talk to you, to hear your voice. I'll let you, Joe, you won't have any problems finishing up without me, will you?
No. No, not at all.
I appreciate it. It's been good talking to you. I'd like to
same here.
At more length if possible. Janie, if you're listening, thanks again for letting me be part of what you're doing here.
Thank you, Stephen, so much, and I just wish you the best.
Well, thank you,
Stephen.
Yeah, no, things are going really, really well.
Oh, that's good.
I may even make it to another show. Who knows?
Great.
Yeah, so it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Lynn.
Hi, Joe.
Hey.
I have to say, I still have that beautiful plate you sent.
Oh, yeah, the copper
piece. It's the centerpiece. It's very beautiful.
I'm glad you enjoy it.
Yes.
So tell me, what's the latest with your Madonna series? Where has she been going lately?
Well, you know, it's funny. I wrote so many of them, and then I stopped, and I realized that I had stopped when Marvin Malone died, and I didn't really write anymore.
Yeah.
Occasionally, people have said they really wanted to do another book, but nothing has really come from it. I carry around a few of the Madonnas with me. I don't think I have them right near my desk, but I keep thinking I'm going to read them. I'll put them together, and I haven't really done much with them. I've done more with the Mad Girl, and I haven't really done anything with them. It's kind of fun. I never really thought about the fact that, like, Marvin Malone really loved them, and he published a lot of them in Wormwood, and it was almost like unconsciously I just stopped writing them when he was no longer here, and so that they haven't really come very far. Something to think about. Very often people will ask me about them and say they want to do it, but it hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of books that, you know, are going to happen but don't happen, even though I've published so many, there's so many that, you know, never did come. You know, they've been, you know, I have a book about the, some of the things like the, well, someone is interested in doing the hurricane book. A book about hurricane poems. But some of the other disasters, they were so interested in doing it, and I've even seen covers for it, but the book has not come out yet. So once it's accepted, you're never really sure it's going to come out.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly not complaining because I've had so many books.
Yes, I'm excited for you, especially with, like you said, within the last year, there's some awesome books out.
This year, you know, I wasn't planning to have so many. In fact, Persephone, which is really one of the biggest, and I'm so sorry you didn't get a copy of it, especially since some people got three. It really was kind of on the idea of some of the Black Sparrow books, and that was actually due quite a long time ago. And then suddenly it came out. And some of the other books, like 92 Raffle Drive, just kind of came about really suddenly from a submission of poems, which is actually how my very first books came out. I just sent out a group of poems, and the press wanted to do it as a book. And that's what happened with 92 Raffle. And it happened a little bit with a couple of other books. It's a little small chapbook, Lost in the Fog, which is another horse book, but not anywhere near as big as, you know, The Ruffian One or Barbaro. But a lot of these came from just a group of poems, and then suddenly some editor or publisher says, well, let's do a book of them.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
But it's also, you know, it's a lot easier when you have a topic or some frame of mind of where you're going with a set of poems when you're working with them instead of just trying to piecemeal some from here and some from there. It's just a lot easier.
With Ruffian, it was really strange. I had what I felt really, really passionate about. I mean, that book.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to send it out, I realized none of the equine publishers were at all interested in it. And it was the first time it was one of the rare times I ever actually wrote queries. And, you know, people wanted to see it, but in the end, a lot of the poetry presses were not interested in something about a horse. So I was stuck with, you know, the horse places wouldn't publish it. And then, you know, finally Texas Review decided to publish it. And that went very smoothly. And, you know, it's turned out to do very, very well. I'm just hoping Barbara does get out and does as well, you know.
I remember when I got my copy of Ruffian, I had to read it all the way through, hoping that something different would turn out in the end.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing set of things.
Yeah, and same with Barbara. With Barbara, I did it a little differently. Like with Ruffian, I knew from the start what the ending was going to be because it was history. Mm-hmm. But when I started with Barbara, I started with the idea I'll write one or two poems, not a book. And then I just became obsessed and kept writing continually. And what happened was, around January, when it still looked hopeful, December and January, a number of books about Barbara, mainly fiction nonfiction prose books, came out. And then, because he died, not suddenly, but in a way it was suddenly, they had to add on like another paragraph or two. And so it was really changed. But I continued to write this for another couple of months. So, you know, I went past Barbara's death into looking back at what he had done and what he had accomplished and what other things he had started off getting people interested in. This whole...
Were you there?
Hi, yes.
Oh.
I don't know what that means. You?
No, I don't either. Nothing showing up on the board.
Yeah, well, that's looking too dark. So I don't know. I'm just hoping it comes out soon.
Me too. I'm anxious to.
It hasn't. It's just. Yes, I'm hoping it comes out soon.
My listening shelf.
right. But I don't think I'm going to be doing any more horse books. I don't know. The little one, you know, the one about Lost in the Fog, it's just a really small book. And you know, I've considered Eight Bells, who was the filly who won. Well, came in second and then died. But I think I've sort of exhausted my horse poems, except for maybe an occasional one. You know, I thought of Secretariat, but it's sort of fun to take a horse that's really well known and then do poetry, because there's usually not much poetry. It's usually, you know, nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think not. I don't know. But I do like to do things like, I think actually, a couple of other poets who did things about either gardens or stamps kind of got me going with that. And it does seem nice to have a theme, you know, like one subject.
Yes, it really does. So what do you have to read for us from?
Okay, let me just take a look. This is from, I'll read something from, now that I've got everything spread around, I'll read something from Persephone, since that is just about the newest one. Let's see. Assuming I haven't. I've got two from there. Is that too many to read?
No, it's fine.
Okay. I'll read this one. This is called Lips. Yours, honey, were so perfect. A little rosebud mouth. Not those huge, puffed-up, blubbery things. My mother says when I pointed out the model's collagen petals. Roses, my mother always said, that's what yours were. And a nice tiny nose. That's from your father. One good thing. Not a big ugly one like I've got. I think of my mother's lips moving close to my hair. How her breath was always sweet. Two thin lips, like your father's, show stinginess. And she was right. A man who couldn't give presents or love, a good word or money. I only remember three things he told me, and all begin with, don't. Though my mother said stories came from those lips and he brought me a big dog, I only remember the thinness of his lips, how his death meant I wouldn't have to leave school to testify for the divorce. Lips. When I came home from camp, I found Love Without Fear in the bathroom and read, if a girl lets a man put his tongue in her lips down there, she'll let him do anything. And then something about deflowering. A strange word, I thought, trying to imagine flowers down there. Rosebuds, not only on my mouth, a petal opening, but a whole bush of petals, a raft of roses someone kneeling would take me away on. A sea of roses, flowers, and my lips. The island we'd escape to. And then, let's see, Well, if you want to ask me some questions, I can wait. I don't want to read too much.
No, go ahead. It's fine.
Okay, let's see. Yeah, I always felt nervous about, when a new book came out because I wouldn't be reading the same poems again. Mm-hmm. I teach a workshop about hair. I don't really teach that many workshops lately, but when I did, I taught hair workshops, and I found it was a really fantastic subject. I mean, I could take 10 people off the street, and I could make them write really great poems about hair. And I began to write some poems, too, and some of them are in the Black Sparrow books, but this is a sort of a newer one.
Okay.
I wear my hair long to remember old boyfriends, aunts, making appointments, telling stylists to cut it short in a flip. I wear my hair long to protest against all the shaved heads at Auschwitz, against the threats of PhD examiners to look more professional and dignified. I want it to smell of lilac wind, want my old cat in its warmth. I long to hang my hair out windows to shy lovers, a dare, a disguise to throw you off. I envy Indian women who can sit on the Black River pouring down their backs. My hair begs to be touched, caught in your fingers, your teeth. It smells of lilies, gardenias, some animal you never want not near once you've stroked it. Taste it, and you'll want to wear it. Wrap dreams deep in it when leaves start to change. Pale as a flag made of the moon, it will guide you, lead you in deeper. I've kept my hair long, every time I go to the hairdresser, they want to cut it, do something with it,
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess I'm just a rebel still. Which was, I guess, was the title of some article that was done when the first Black Sparrow came out, something like Always the Rebel or something like that.
Yeah. When I think of your poems, I think of the rich images of plums and forsythia and tangerine geese. And
yeah, amazing. One editor said, I never want to see another poem with plum in it again.
No more plum poems?
Yeah, no, I will. I won't. I don't think he wanted any more poems in general.
So tell me a little bit about your ballet classes. I understand I think you're doing more ballroom now?
I'm really doing more ballroom, and I used to take a ballet class every morning, and mm-hmm. it was only like 20 minutes away. I'd walk to the metro, enough time to work on a little bit of writing, come back, it would still be noon, and I'd have the rest of the day to work. And then the ballet studio moved, and I got my license at 16, but I just hate driving around here very far. So the place where the new ballet studio is just not suitable. So I'm now go from Virginia through D.C. to Maryland for one studio, and then go a couple sometimes into D.C. And so I just don't have everyday ballet. And somehow I also got started on ballroom almost every night. And with both of these, writing comes really easily to me, but dancing doesn't. But there I am, kind of just working at it. And the poems about dance have been very mixed, some of them are very, very serious, and some of them are pretty cynical. I did a whole long, mostly not too recently, group of ballet poems, and as I said, someone is doing a book called Ballet Madonnas, but they're just sort of some short poems, and they are the Madonna poems. Many of them are Ballet Madonnas, but they're all kind of short, and it's just a little chapbook. It doesn't have most of the ballet poems in it. And with the ballroom poems, I have some very strange observations. I'm not sure how they will go over. I have a couple. I have a friend who is very into my writing for now, and I'm not sure how he'll feel about these poems. But I think they're good. And some
are they that different, or just
probably not that different, but they are a little different.
Mm-hmm.
They're there's rumba and tango. Even in that last poem, one of the poems I read, the tango came into it. I'm finding dance terms are coming in quite often. Especially tango, it seems. I'm not sure why. And almost always it seems very dangerous.
A little fiery dance.
Yeah. You know, I just, it's just something that is so everyday that it sort of cuts down, you know, the time that's free, which I used to always count on. I used to take ballet at night a lot. And it's good for now. I'm not sure what will come of that. But I do plan to do a lot more dance bombs.
That's great. What is your reading schedule like?
I used to read all the time. I used to read. I would be on the road like at least three, four or five times a week. I mean a month. And I'm doing a lot less than I used to. I recently read in New York at Cafe Cornelia and up at Lena's in Saratoga Springs. And I have some readings for the fall. I don't have anywhere near as many, and I really should be doing this. In this area, there's, like, every night of the week, there's lots of, you know, readings and open readings. And, you know, most of the times I'm usually at dance, so I don't really go to that many.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done as many as I used to, but I have a couple of big ones coming up. But they're not right away. They're in December, and in, I think it's February. And I'll probably read from Barbaro at the National Museum of, National Museum of Racing in Saratoga Springs. Once that comes out, do a book signing there. But I still need to get my hands on the book before I can really plan that. I really want to work harder at getting the books that are out, getting them, you know, known. And I know readings, that's a good way to do it, but you can't read from 9 books very easily. So it's been a complication. It sounds really great to have so many books, but it's sort of hard. When I do Ruffian, I really have done a lot of readings where I really talk a lot about her. And always in the audience are some, you know, real horse people who are trying to find something to catch me up on, you know. She's a poet. She won't know the number of furlongs. She won't know the year. She won't know the jockey. She won't know the trainer. So it's like I have to prepare for a PhD exam almost. But I really have done, you know, a lot of work organizing that reading and giving it in many places. And now with so many books, I haven't been able to focus the way I would like to. But I hope to now. It's a little bit quieter right now, except when Barbaro comes, which I hope is really this week.
Well, have they said definitely anything?
Excuse me?
Have they said anything definite about the book?
Well, the last I heard, it had gone to the printer.
Oh, excellent.
So I thought that meant... That was about a little while ago, and I let the man who did the cover photograph know, and I said, we should have copies very soon.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't. But we should. I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
I was really lucky to find a fairly beginning photographer who happened to have a really nice Barbaro photograph, and... I'm really pleased to have it because I don't think it's been used on anything else. And I'm just really, you know, since this is the time of the Triple Crown and this is the high point besides the Breeders' Cup for people interested in, you know, in horses, I really want to get the book out, and I want to have it in Saratoga because Saratoga is just a wonderful place in the summer, you know, for anything to do with horses. And I'm a member of the Hall of Fame for horses, and I just would like to have it out, but I can just wait patiently. I promise to be patient, and I will have to be.
Yeah. How about some more poems?
Okay, let's see. I'm going to try to find some that are kind of short. Let's see. Do you have any type of poem? I'm not sure. Oh, let me read. Here's a prose poem. Gargoyle published a number of these poems, and I have them in a new manuscript that isn't out yet, but, I have it circulating. Actually, they weren't written as prose poems, but the typist typed them as prose poems, and I kind of like it that way. On the night the most handsome poet walked out of the Schenectady Community College reading alone, headed up State Street, it was June, still light, alone. I couldn't believe it. The last raspberry light over the old downtown buildings. I watched him pass Proctor's, the only lit up building, past boarded up cafes. I could not believe there was not a flotilla of women behind him. I had not written a poem yet. I was afraid to ask him to autograph the book I clutched. Alone. After all the women he left in tears. Sometimes sent yellow roses to. Sometimes mourned on the page. Alone. The most handsome. Even years later, I could never tell him. It was like seeing a Bugatti, a Lamborghini, somehow in the living room, to see him just leaving alone, strolling through the town, empty as a de Chirico painting, while I stood with my mother in front of the bookstore that no longer is, held my breath. Now, read, take the paperclip out and read a couple of other ones from this. Let's see. I put paperclips in to sort of organize them. Kind of in the way. That's another, you know, wonderful magazine, Gargoyle, and I've always found that whatever they printed, I've usually ended up including, you know, in a collection. Mm-hmm. This one is, I'm seeing that I'm using a lot of kind of things from, I don't know, from newspapers or TV or something, but this is... When I see Sarah Jessica Parker is replaced by Joss Stone for Gap, I'm thinking, what happened again. The daughter replacing the mother, blooming as the mother starts to fade. I rarely write about being less young, a euphemistic way to beat around what I'm thinking. It's like a man clutching a tumor growing big as a Siamese twin. There. And tell me truly, can you stop looking at it? In your mirror, across the table, the lines that never mattered deepening, hair thinner. When I saw Joss Stone singing that Janis Joplin blues, gorgeous taut skin, Melissa Etheridge, bald head, both belting the blue blues out, Joss's arms lovely, a white, I bet nothing has slid from abruptly, leaving a burn, a scar, and so sure she's hot and her teeth are lovely. But I want Sarah, I want her blues, her over 30 beauty to mirror mine. And here's one about, oh, this is Rose, this is going, well, Rose. Rose. When it's behind my knees, you'd have to fall to the floor, lower your whole body like horses in a field to smell it. White rose, Bulgarian rose. I think of sheets I've left my scent in, as if to stake a claim for someone who could never care for anything alive. This Bulgarian rose, spicy, pungent, rose as my rose 16th birthday party dress, rose lips, nipples. If you won't fall to your knees, at least please nuzzle like those horses, these roses, somewhere. And I don't know if we have time for another. I don't know what your, you know, what the time is, but this is one that is in the film. Oh, someone did a documentary film about me, and this is the film is really good, but it's kind of hard to get right now. But this was, I was filmed reading this in front of a stone building that was used for someone to write with. Mm-hmm. You know the story of the woman in a turret and how ivy puts its finger across the moon. And besides, no one could hear. Ivy that grows forever against the dankest part of a wall, gnawing gargoyles deep in the belly of the house. I would have lowered my hair to a lover, lured him with blood in a bottle, each drop a ruby with a poem etched on it, or carved my initials in the gray stone around my heart. I'd have talked to the birds or waited, slept 20 years, given away my children. Only I was outside, trying to get in. It's one of those poems that I think knows more than I do what it's about.
That's good. Oh, to get back to the question, we have a good 15 minutes.
Okay. Let me see. Are you ready for a funny poem?
Yes.
This is okay. If you saw my desk right now, tea, cough drops, water. Okay. This is an early poem. I once gave a reading on the steps of the Capitol years ago, and this was cut, but I don't know why, because there's nothing in it. He was really my favorite student, dark, and just back from the army with hot olive eyes, telling me of bars, and the first time he got a piece in Greece, or maybe it was Italy, and drunk on some strange wine, and I thought, in spite of his dangling pronoun, being 24 and never touched, but in my soft nougat thighs, that he would be a lovely experience. So I shaved my legs up high, and when he came talking of footnotes, I locked him tight in my snug black file cabinet, where I fed him twice a day. And hardly anyone noticed how we lived among blue books in the windowless office, rarely coming up for sun, or the change in his pronoun, or the rusty creaking chair. Or that many years later, we were still going to town in novels I never had time to finish. That's also in the documentary film. So here's one that's kind of, I'm just going to take a sip of tea. This is based on a story that a woman told me, and when I first read it, people kept coming to me and saying, "Oh my God, I didn't know this," and they were so emotional. Some were crying, and I just didn't know what to say. I didn't want to tell them that this isn't about me, so I never said anything for so long. But it's a story. I remember Haifa being lovely. I remember Haifa being lovely, but there were snakes in the tent. My mother was strong, but she never slept, was afraid of dreaming. In Auschwitz, there was a numbness, lull of just staying alive. Her two babies gasped before her. "Dr. Mengele, do you know who he is?" She kept her young sister alive, only to have her die in her arms the night of liberation. My mother is big-boned, but she weighed under 70 pounds. It was hot. I thought the snakes lovely. There were no drugs in Israel, no food. I got pneumonia. My mother knocked the doctor to the floor when he refused. She said, "I lost two in the camp, and if this one dies, I will kill myself in front of you." I thought that once you became a mother, blue numbers appeared mysteriously, tattooed on your wrist. So you can see why after reading that, I wouldn't want to.
Is that from your blue tattoo collection?
You know, actually it's not.
No?
The Blue Tattoo Collection, it's actually in Before It's Light. And if anyone is interested in getting that, that's one of the Black Sparrow books. Sadly, the last couple of lines from that were cut off and they could never be replaced. I thought it would go into another edition, but then when everything changed, of course it didn't. And, you know, without those last two lines, it's a little bit strange. So every time I sell it at a reading, I write those lines, you know, into it.
Yeah, I know.
But
from my
The Blue Tattoo was done mostly from sort of like based. The publisher wanted to make it seem like an articles, like you know, newspaper clips. And I know you've seen it. It's printed like almost like a newspaper with columns, you know. And some people don't like it, and some people do. But he did not use that one. And I know it's confusing because that's one of the strongest. One of the poems that I have, and there are others in the Blue Tattoo, but this one, I think, is one of my, you know, one of my favorites.
Yeah, me too. It reminded me of Blue Tattoo. That's why I was asking.
Right.
For some reason, on the drive here to San Antonio, I was thinking of that particular book of yours.
Yeah, that sold fairly well. They have it at the Holocaust Museum. I've kind of lost touch with the publishers. I don't think they're publishing anymore. It's really weird how sometimes a book will go out of print and I never know about it, you know. And that happened to Black Apples. I was supposed to go and get extra copies of it, and there was just a little glitch, and the next thing I knew, it had all been destroyed. So I have some extra copies. But since then, I try to get extra copies. But, you know, every once in a while, there's like a couple of books, I have one or two copies, and I just, you know, they're the ones that people, if I go to a reading, they're the ones that people often want.
Wow.
Because they're just not available.
Black Apples went into two editions, didn't it?
Three. Actually went to three editions.
Wow. That's great.
The first one had a kind of a crude kind of an apple tree on it, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was really probably the most beautiful. It had a shiny, slick cover. And the third one had a white cover a black cover with a white border, but it wasn't that nice, shiny paper.
Wow.
But the first, I think they're all the same, except I think maybe the last two have more poems. Someone was talking to me, and I still feel that that's one of the stronger books, although what I consider the strongest poems actually have been, you know, put into Cold Comfort from Black Sparrow and...
For the doctor poems?
What?
The doctor poems?
That's another book that's kind of strange. I haven't really done too much really reading from that, but that has that has a mixture of poems in it. Yeah, so my PhD times were really, really terrible times, but great for subjects. You know, I used to say that the worst things end up being the best material for poetry, and
yeah,
I must say that was true. The two poems that are in Black Sparrow books, and one is called Orals, and the other is You Understand the Requirements, and You Understand the Requirements has also been anthologized quite a lot, and, you know, I used to read it so often that people would say, please. The couple of poems, No More Apologizing, which is too long to read now, is sort of a poem that I used to often, you know, start a reading with, because I knew it always had a good reaction, and I felt comfortable with it. And I often close with Arizona Runes, which somehow to me is still good. But they're both kind of long, and, you know, I've read them a lot. I have a number of poems that you can, you know, hear on my website, and I'm pretty sure both of those are on
Well,
there.
Of your latest, six volumes, which are getting the best responses when you're reading?
Well, I've really been...
really tested all of them.
I've been really reading from Persephone.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a great response from the Jesus poems. I haven't been doing as many readings as, you know, from the others as I really want to, and I feel really lax about it, and I sort of feel guilty, so I need to start working on that. It's just that partly Red Hen, you know, kind of arranged some Red Hen readings, so I knew I had to prepare those. And since it takes me a while to read a poem before I feel comfortable with it. Although I've actually been doing a lot of readings for the first time lately. But I'd say Persephone and the Jesus poems, really. And, you know, of course, I don't know, The Licorice Daughter, of course, is really still. And also the last Black Sparrow book, which isn't immediately out, but just not that recently out, but Another Woman Who Looks Like Me also is, you know, is something that I often read from. I could read one poem from that. Let's see.
Okay.
If I still have a voice. Let's see. I'll read. There's two. Let's see, I'm not sure if they're both in there. Now, I actually had this very neatly organized, but now they're sort of spread around. But one, whoops. One is, let's see. One is about growing up in a small town and being, you know, the only Jewish family there, and the other one is about going to the Catholic school, so I'm going to just quickly try to find this.
All right.
They should be right here. Oh, I could read a Barbie poem while I'm waiting, but no, I'll find this. That's one of the problems of having so many poems, is you can't really find them sometimes. Okay, I think this is it. Well, I'm going to, let's see. Let me just put the phone down for a second, okay?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm playing with the poems.
Maybe you could read a poem while I'm doing it. Okay. Here they are together. Okay. The first one is being Jewish in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Someone writes kike on the blackboard, and the K's pull through the chalk, stick in my plump, pale thighs. Even after the high school burns down, the word is written in the ashes. My underpants elastic snaps on Main Street because I can't go to Pilgrim Fellowship. I'm the one Jewish girl in town, but the four Cohen brothers want blonde hair blowing from their car. They don't know my black braids smell of almonds. I wear my clothes loose so no one dreams who I am. We'll never know Hebrew. Keep a Christmas tree in my drawer. In the dark, my fingers could be the menorah that pulls you toward honey in the snow. And kind of a companion piece, I guess, to that is going to the Catholic school. Once a year, bundled in wool peacoats and snowy pants, mufflers dotted with ice crystals tightly around our faces, so the incense we were sure would be too thick to breathe in wouldn't make us sneeze. Under our snow pants, soft corduroy jeans. Over our gloves, our thickest mittens. We had heard about rulers smashing bones and skin. That patent leather shoes were forbidden. Something about the stained glass light on the pale nuns with enormous crosses and rosaries kept us huddled and close, walking with only sidelong glances at the Jesus with bleeding chest. As scary as the thing where Jessica, whose father was a minister, shrieked when the blob filled the screen. We didn't know why the Catholic girls couldn't come to our school, but would come later in high school, or why everything had a smell we never smelled anywhere else, or how we'd ever catch up in Latin when we had to. The dark-haired girls with their dangling faces of Mary they kissed before a ball game or a test seemed as exotic as what was hidden under their white confirmation dresses. Flesh we heard would later writhe and twist and do the wild thing, since it would be okay once they confessed. Here's one, another one. Actually, I think it might be the first poem in Persephone. Lorca and Dylan Thomas were kind of my favorite poets when I was in, you know, undergraduate, and I picked Dylan Thomas to write my master's thesis on, and probably if I continued, might have done something more with Lorca, but instead I've got Sleeping with Lorca. It's not true. He never chose women. I ought to know. It was Granada, and the sun falling behind the Alhambra was flaming lava. I could say I was too, but some things should be left unsaid. But I remember his fingers on the button at the back of my neck. My skin burned as he fumbled with rhinestones and pearls. I want you, breathed into my neck, though perhaps he was whispering, green, green, I want you green. How little he needed to impress me with his poems. One English term paper with him, and I was naked, taken. It wouldn't matter if he had a pot belly or stank of garlic. My jeans were a puddle around my knees. I was the gored bull, hypnotized by moves I'd only imagined, but never believed would enter me. There's more you might coax me to say, but for now, it's enough. I can still smell the green wind. That 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that would never be another time. He's still one of my favorite writers. Recently I did an article on 10 writers that I think everyone should read. And
well, Lynn, we have five minutes.
Okay. Do you want me to read something or do you want to ask me something?
Have a little poem to read.
Okay. Do you want a funny one or a serious
sure.
one?
Okay.
How about a Barbie poem?
A Barbie poem.
Okay.
Come on.
I think I've just said that and... Where is the rest of it? Okay. Okay. Barbie hunts through medical books, looking to see what is wrong with her, when she sees the date in a book and knows she is over 30 and feels so hollow inside, unfulfilled, as if all she's done is change her clothes. She wonders about the women's movement. Maybe, she frowns, it's the chain. And she hasn't even had a baby, had a period, a hair that was not in place. Perfection that can be shelved, one yank and I'd be bald and naked. She flips through chapters on neurosis, wonders if it's hormones she lacks. Where she's been hardly seems to matter. The beach, Sun Valley, Spain. It's all facade, going through the motions. What did a wedding get me, she groans. I never was freewheeling, as they said in 1975. But empty, full of holes. Something just for someone else to collect or abuse. So that's Barbie.
Wonderful. Well, Lynn, it's been great, and I appreciate your time. It's just wonderful to hear your voice, and I'll enjoy the
poem. It's wonderful to talk to you after all the email and letters. And
yes, yes.
This is really fun.
Yes, it was great.
I'm sorry I had been yelling for the cat for so long, and I hope I have my voice back soon. Next time I'll have my voice.
All right. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Jane. Thanks again, Lynn.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, guys, so we're in the last few minutes. I want to thank Lynn Lifshin for coming on the program today.
Oh, thank you, Jane, for inviting me.
It was absolutely wonderful. I'm really glad that you got to speak with Stephen and with Joseph today. It was a really great interview. I was listening upstairs as he was downstairs on my computer running the switchboard.
Oh, it's great meeting you, too. I mean, all these emails and, you know, having
it's
a real
nice.
Voice.
It's wonderful, and I really thank you a lot for being in Heavy Bear.
Oh,
it's
thank
been
you
a
so
really
much.
Great pleasure. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too.
You enjoy the rest of your afternoon, and I'm going to let you go.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
Take
a
care.
Lot, Lynn.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, guys, so we're in the last 2 minutes. I want to thank everyone who's been on the program today, including, of course, Stephen Morse, who was the main host, and Joseph Trombatore, who was my co-host today. You guys may be hearing a few more sort of artist-on-artist shows that are going to be coming up. Artie Armstrong has a show planned for sometime in June. Look on the calendar, go to janecrown.com, and you'll see sort of what's happening when he has a show and other things that are happening. Next Sunday I have, always at the same time, 2 o'clock Pacific, 3 o'clock Mountain, 4 o'clock Central, which is my time here in San Antonio, Texas, 5 o'clock Eastern. And that will be Naomi Lewinsky, who is a really wonderful poet, and I think you guys will really enjoy her. I want to let you know that you can always go find Lynn on my site. You can find Joseph Trombatore on my site. You can find Stephen Morse on my site. If you look under magazines and journals, you'll find one for Radiant Turnstile, which is Joseph Trombatore's. And if you look for Juice Press under the same link, you'll find the one for Juice Press, which is Stephen Morse. Also, of course, not to mention, Lynn Lifshin. If you look under writers, she's in the gallery. Click it there, and there's a ton of information and everything that you ever wanted to know about Lynn, and you'll be able to find her books there. So thank you for listening today, and I will see you next Sunday. Take care. Bye-bye.